Hi there, and welcome to Everyday Business with me, Aidan Donnelly. I've been analysing and investing in companies for nearly 30 years, and I'm fascinated by how companies operate, the entrepreneurs who start them, and the business people and managements that run them. In this podcast series, I'll be talking to a whole host of people with different stories, backgrounds, and journeys, learning about their businesses and gleaning some insights and lessons from their experience. For those that are listening, don't forget to like, share, and subscribe if you enjoy what you hear. And without further ado, let's get to today's episode. While you might disagree, Brian Thorne strikes me as an accidental entrepreneur. Coming from a medical family, his father was an oncologist and immunologist. Brian studied medicine in Trinity before interning in the Meath and Adelaide hospitals. After a year in Brisbane, he returned to Ireland to commence his orthopaedic training, working in many of the hospitals around the country. An interest in ankle and anatomy and injuries, the result of a water skiing accident, ultimately led him to inventing tightrope in 2000, which he ultimately licensed to Arthex in 2003, with the first surgery performed in 2004. In 2005, he quit the orthopaedic scheme to try his luck in business, 2 to 3 years short of becoming a consultant. Then in 2007, came his light bulb moment for the second product, X-Bolt, for the treatment of hip fractures. And in 2018, he got FDA approval for the first generation of the product. Since then, further developments have been made with the introduction of a full portfolio in titanium-based products for other anatomical areas in 2021. Brian, you're very welcome to the podcast and thanks for joining me.
Thanks very much, Aidan.
First off, I suppose the easiest thing to do is let's talk about the product suites. You've got the tightrope and you've got the X-Bolt. Tell me a little bit about them and what they do and the light bulb moment, if you will, on both of them.
Yeah, so I'll start with tightrope first. Tightrope was, like I said, an accidental kind of invention. So the time in my life, I was an orthopaedic registrar looking to advance myself on the scheme, and I had an interest in ankle injuries because of my own situation with that water skiing accident. I was just lying in bed one day and one night, it occurred to me for these type of injuries, syndesmosis injuries, that patients coming through needed two operations, one to put in the screw and one to take it out again. And I thought, this is bonkers. We're in the 21st century here. You know, can we not just do it with one implant, one surgery, and then, you know, the patient can rehab much quicker? So my kind of goal at that stage was just to get a research paper and advance my CV. And I did that. I started off then. I did a biomechanical study in Trinity College. That was fun. We did it in the dead of December. We got good results from that. And on the back of that, I was down in Limerick and we ran a 16-patient study with a prototype tightrope. And that worked very well. And it was only then when we were doing the study and the physios came back to me and said, Brian, these patients are rehabbing really fast. They're doing much better than the usual screw-based patients. And you might be onto something here. And then sort of the penny dropped that this could be commercial. So I'd gone probably 1 or 2 years with it. So my next goal then was to reach out to find a patent lawyer. And it took a couple of phone calls and eventually got through to F.R. Kelly's in Dublin. And we had our first meeting, which was probably the best 50 quid or 100 quid, whatever it cost at that time, to just work out what the landscape is with it. And they said that, you know, you could be on something here. We filed the application. And then I, with my clinical data and my patent my patent application, I talked to any medical device company that was around. And Arthrex, who are based in Naples, Florida, they came back and they seemed to be a very good bunch to work with. So I signed up with them. But it all happened very quick. In the space of like a year, year and a half, I'd gone from having this clinical data to actually having kind of a fairly good conversation with a medical device company. And so from invention to signing a contract, it was 3 years. So it was a very fast turnaround and fast exit.
Now, 50,000 units are sold every year. That's one used every 12 minutes, I've seen in the stat, which is quite incredible. But what I'm more interested in is it includes very many sports professionals, rugby and NFL. Are there any famous ones that we might know of?
Oh, it's nuts how many that get put in. Like, again, I don't tend to think or hear about it. And unfortunately, in Ireland, like about a third of the Irish rugby team have one in them. So anyone who's had an ankle injury in the last, say, 10, 15 years has probably got a tightrope in them. I can't name them for
obvious reasons
here. But in the US, they're much more likely to disclose what they get put in them. So Tua, who's the Miami Dolphins quarterback when he was in Alabama, he had both his ankles fixed with tightropes, and they actually ran a whole sort of halftime slot on the tightrope. Jalen Hurts, who's the highest paid athlete in the US, he just signed a new deal for, I think, $245 million of an extension. He's a tightrope in both his ankles. So it is, again, anyone in the NFL who's had an ankle injury in the last, say, 10 years will have my device in it. So it's just, and it, like I said, it's an absolute household name there, because it gets put in the sports radio shows. It's just talk tightrope all the time.
Mm-hmm. And X-Bolt, where did that come from, and where is that?
Yeah, so X-Bolt is another kind of more interesting light bulb moment. So I always knew the problem of osteoporotic bone, and when I started off in orthopedics, I wanted to be a trauma surgeon. Well, I did 10 years in doing trauma surgery, and you think trauma is like sports injuries, motorbikes, this sort of stuff, but actually the vast majority of trauma surgery is elderly people who are of osteoporotic bone, and it's very hard to take a screw. It's sort of like putting a screw into wet chipboard or something like that. So the light bulb moment came when I was putting a plasma screen up on the wall, and I needed the biggest sort of wall anchor that I could find. So I was in the hardware store, and I thought one of these might be good for fixing hip fractures. So I just made the leap from one industry to another. It's not exactly the same. I mean, there's other issues clearly go into making a medical device.
So.
Yeah, it's really fashioned off that, but there was definitely a light bulb moment with that, and the design has pretty much stayed the same over the last 10 years or so.
What do you consider yourself, an entrepreneur, an inventor, or an orthopaedic surgeon?
Oh gosh, well, surgeon first, inventor second, entrepreneur third, I guess would be the thing. I always think like a surgeon, and I think surgery as well, going into business, helps you a lot, because as a surgeon, every day your risk—it's risk benefit. You know, do you make a bigger exposure opening up the bone of the surgical field versus minimally invasive stuff? I mean, sometimes you have to open it up just to get a better view or better reduction on your bone or whatever. So, you're playing off things all the time, and in business, it is kind of the same, that you're playing off one set of risks to another.
Could you go back to the shop floor? Could you go back into a theatre?
I'd love to know. I get that asked quite a lot. I'd love to go back as a testimonial, like as a sports player, just come in and do one. I was talking to a buddy of mine about that lately, and he said, "Fire ahead, you can come in anytime next week. We're snowed
jammed
under here." Yeah.
The role of an entrepreneur, I suppose, and again, for people who you know, come at it in a kind of an accidental fashion, the same way you have, they don't probably realise that there's an awful lot to it in terms of, you know, it's not just about developing the product. You've then got to raise capital, you've got to manage the business, you've got to build the business and things like that. And it's very difficult for people to be very good at all of those things.
Totally, yeah. So I guess as an entrepreneur, your first hires are key. And I hired people to fill the skill set that I don't have. Mm-hmm. You know, coming again from a clinical background, you have a certain skill set. But we have engineers and regulatory people and finance people that help me out, where, and clearly in areas that I'm not proficient in. So you become a little bit of a jack of all trades, that you kind of get, you obviously have to know all the aspects of the company. But hiring is key to the growth as an entrepreneur, I think.
And you know, you said to me earlier, one of the drivers for the move at the very start of the business was the poor reaction you got from medical medical colleagues. But those medical colleagues, in a certain way, have now become customers, right? So do you have to bite your tongue?
Well, like I think Ireland, it's probably more of a culture thing in Ireland. Right. You know, we're a bit more, I think, begrudging of success or business people. I mean, we're running a podcast here, which is fantastic. But some people just think that you can only get ahead by sort of nefarious means. Mm. And I think there was the speed between, you know, 3 years between inventing this thing on just a research project and getting a contract, I think did put people's noses out of joint. And I was conscious of that at the time. And it's a very small, like a lot of industries, it's quite a small community that we're in, and everybody knows what everyone else's business is. So I think it was great to leave. I mean, there was a breath of fresh air that you actually see that there's a more of a global approach to what you do. But yeah, that time was quite tough for me, you know, because I was, on one hand, I was trying to advance my orthopedic career and keep my nose clean, as it were. And then the other hand, I had this fantastic, exciting project that was going ahead. And it came to a head then in 2005. And I felt that I'm never going to get this opportunity again to actually explore and see what industry might be like. Being creative is fantastic. You know, I'm probably one of those people that doesn't like to do things by protocol. I was always find another way of doing things, and that probably doesn't sit too well with maybe some of my seniors, or even as medicine is now. It's very protocol based, whereas being an innovator trying to do things differently doesn't fit that sort of square peg in a round hole. So I made that decision in 2005 to leave and sort of roll the dice for a couple of years and see if it worked out. I think I was lucky in a way not to, you know, I had a financial cushion with the tightrope royalties then that were starting to come in. And, you know, if things didn't, if things went south, then I guess I could have gone back to clinical medicine.
But you look at it and, you know, medicine is obviously one area, but do you think in general there is a kind of a gap between, you know, you look at something like medicine and you kind of say to yourself, well, the people who are going to likely discover the next big medical device are the people who are working in the industry. So it's a kind of, is there a better way to kind of get, you know, entrepreneurs/engineers to be more aligned and working with medical professionals to develop all of these? Because granted, a doctor might not want to do it, but they have a huge volume of knowledge that would be invaluable to an engineer who knows nothing about such and such.
Yeah, I think there's a whole range of doctors come in all obviously shapes and sizes, sort of from an innovating point of view. I mean, some people are very happy to follow those protocols, but yeah, to capture the innovation in it. And actually, now that I've left, it's great because I'm one of the first ports of call for other people who have inventions or ideas, and it's kind of like, where do I go to next? And you see it and you try to help those sort of people along.
Yeah. In terms of support from others at the early stage, you know, wife, family, emotional, financial support, what was that journey like?
Yeah, it was good. My wife's a doc as well. I met her when I was in Beaumont, working with Ray Moran. I tell that every time I see him. marriage is still going strong anyway. Thanks, Ray. But yeah, the kids are all grand. I don't think one of the other questions sort of medics tend to ask is, would you put your kids through medicine as well? I've been out of medicine now out of clinical medicine for what now, 16, 17 years or so. But I don't think, I think it's the medical scene has somewhat changed in the time that I was there. It's like I said, it's more structured, more rote learning. I think different things coming into medicine now, I think that with the AIs coming into a lot of aspects of medicine, it's going to be a completely changed career and opportunities for doctors going forward. So I think it's nicer to be on the creative side rather than actually the production side, really, of clinical medicine.
You mentioned talking about, you know, advice to kids and things like that. What advice would you give to your younger self and to young people in general? Because I'm hoping we have a decent cohort of young people, and not just from the medicine background, but also maybe from the entrepreneurial or the business background.
Yeah, medicine's a great career. I mean, it's a great stepping stone for a lot of other things. It's a longish journey in terms of education. But I think from the creative side, I think there's going to be more innovation through digital technologies, AIs, engineering. And I think if you are a creative, I think you might be better off into one of those as a thing. What I found as well is that, again, I've sort of ploughed my own furrow, but you do need a lot of support. And from other aspects, you know, from engineering side, from science side, that one person can't do it all. You need help around you to innovate.
And who have you sought help from over the last 15 odd years?
From a clinical perspective, gosh, that's a tough one. It's probably more on the business side. Much more on the business side. So at the moment, maybe a shout out to we've a great my chief operations officer Phil Kemp. He's an American. Previously worked with Stryker, and he's been an enormous help to me in terms of bringing us more commercial ready. And we're planning to launch in the States now at the end of this year. But you know, thanks to Phil, he's really brought the company on leaps and bounds.
The X-Bolt was probably a more traditional product life cycle in there. It was elongated. It wasn't like the tightrope one that came very, very quick. But, you know, how important has it been then to have, you know, your capital investors and even your board aligned to your goals and your targets for the company and the product?
Yeah, we might be a little bit different than a lot of other medical device companies that are raising cash. So I've invested in every round, and I still hold half the share capital in the company. So it's almost like a family business with extra investors thrown in. So the board, albeit investors all themselves, don't probably wield the same amount of control as maybe other med tech startups would have. And I'm very thankful to the board for a lot of the advice that they gave and the direction. So it's a very pleasant place to work. We're not up against any sort of deadlines or funding crises. Like we do have kind of pinch points, I guess, in our time. But thankfully, I've been able to dig into my own pockets and bring the company through. So we've gone through, you know, a few hard times, I guess, with the various financial crashes and the like. But thanks. I think we're in a happy place in that regard.
You mentioned about the board. One of our previous guests was Gary McGann, and Gary said to me, he said, you have to remember the thing about your board of directors is they are the cheapest form of consultants that you'll ever get. And he says, you should always make sure you've got the right people on there and you're using them to the best of their ability.
Yeah, I could probably use them a little bit more. I think they've on clinical grounds, they obviously look to me. Most of our kind of... in our previous history, we ran big clinical trials in the UK, and we had ups and downs with that. So the finance people on the board just sort of nodded sagely when we were going through those angst moments. But yeah, the board are very good. I'm kind of happy that we've got a good structure. But for where we're at the moment, we're sort of pivoting from an R&D phase to a commercial phase. And I do think that we probably do as a board, if they're listening in, we probably need to pivot a little bit in terms of becoming more commercial savvy.
And you know, when you look at the market now, or the industry now, or the cycle now, is it very different to what it would have been 15 years ago in terms of getting a medical product to market?
Yeah, it's got a lot tougher. The biggest shakeup in the med tech space has been the MDR, the European Medical Device Regulations. Previously, if you were going to launch a medical device, you'd start using it in Europe because the CE mark was the easier route to go, and then once you've established usage there, you go to the States. Whereas now the States is actually an easier path through the FDA.
And is that because the FDA has gotten easier, or Europe has gotten more difficult?
Europe has gotten more difficult. Okay. I think Europe, and it's quite sad. I think it's quite sad in a way because, like for us, we've got a I'm, you know, Irish and a European essentially, and you have an innovative product, but then you are exporting it across the pond to get your initial usage and not doing it primarily in your own backyard.
And is there a risk that Europe misses out as a result of
Definitely,
that?
Yeah. I mean, we'll be second to the table.
All right. Just the other thing I was interested to get your thoughts on is, you know, obviously tightrope, you licensed. X-Bolt, you're kind of commercializing and bringing yourself to market. Explain the thought process to both for me, and was it ever an option that you would have licensed X-Bolt as well, or did you really want to actually run it as a business?
Yeah, with Tightrope to begin with, licensing was the obvious choice, because I was still a career surgeon at that time, and to license it is lower risk for the acquirer, and it's all upside. I'm not taking any risk whatsoever. Just wait for the royalty checks to come through. For now, I think when I started off with X-Bolt, I thought I had the formula that you invent a device, you do biomechanical studies, you do clinical studies, and then you sell it or license it. I think we've got the suite of products now, which is much bigger and wider, that would fit into a portfolio of a bigger company. We've just grown beyond that licensing kind of phase as a company. But it's a noble exit for anyone who has a medical device idea.
There's an awful lot of very, very big gorillas in the medical device market. And, you know, what I often see is your access and your time to surgeons is minuscule because they're very, very busy. And there's always this kind of conflict between that, trying to get in front of them and things like that. And it naturally falls that the big guys can muscle their way through, you know, more successfully probably than anybody else, to get, you know, if you shout the loudest, you get heard. So how is the approach to market going to work for that? Is it truly because you've got a really innovative product and that's what gets you in the door?
Yeah, we're completely product-based.
Right.
Company, and it's the experience in the operating theatre that I think makes a difference. I mean, obviously, I'm a surgeon founder, and the product is, it sort of speaks to the heart of what a surgeon would want. You know, a surgeon likes to have new gear. I mean, a surgeon wants to do fun surgery. You've got gadgets. I mean, it's a fantastic job that you've got all this great gear in front of you. So our device, in a nutshell, in terms of the feel you get putting in a screw into that wet chipboard, and knowing you want to get it as tight as possible, but not going so far that it you shoot the threads and it loosens. And that happens in surgery. Whereas with our X-Bolt, you put in the bolt and with the same screwdriver, you open it up and you actually feel then the resistance of the bone. But you don't never have that oh shit moment of it, you know, suddenly loosening.
Get real, we need another hole.
so the surgeon's left happy that they've actually done something, you know, useful, or they've got that haptic feedback of good surgery. And the same thing with tightrope as well, that you can hang off the threads of the tightrope and pull it really, really tight, and you get a good feeling of doing it as tight as you can, rather than trying to baby it in that you might go a little bit too hard and mess things up. So it's these small little things that I think surgeons might like in the surgical setting.
And again, I suppose the key to an awful lot of the products you see now is either quicker time to recovery or lower risk that you need to go in again.
Yeah, I mean, it's hip fractures. The value proposition for X-Bolt is huge. We've very elderly populations are growing worldwide, and if we can, with hip fractures being like the number one trauma operation that goes through, and in the US one episode costs about 50,000 per episode, and if it goes wrong it's another 40,000 that goes wrong. So for every one you can prevent, it's a huge saving.
Okay, the when it comes to the business, you know, do you obsess about the small things? Because traditionally, any surgeons I've met a few, they tend to be myopic in nature in terms of very, very laser focused. Are you like that within the business?
I don't know. Maybe I am. I am definitely on the design side of things. Mm-hmm. I mean, I absolutely, you know, every little thing for that surgeon interface, I want to know about. Right down to, you know, just some of the filleting on the edges. I think that makes a huge difference. I was thinking about this when I was listening to one of your other podcasts, whatever. I'm the type of person who has a very messy desk.
Right.
Some people have neat desks, some people have messy desks. I'm a messy desk person, but I know where everything is, and that's probably the type of person that I am.
How do you feel about what you've done already in the company?
Well, this year I feel good. Yeah. We're on the cusp of launching in the US, and it's some very exciting times ahead. We've managed to sort of pivot and do things nicely. Like through the COVID years, we invented all this extra suite of products, so we made use of the time. So being a small company, you're able to pivot and do things as they come along
and reframe the business as is necessary.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Like we're small. I mean, there's nine of us in the office, so we can adapt to whatever the needs are. And you find when you're developing stuff that you might have 2 or 3 weeks hard on one particular workflow, and then maybe you send it off to get prototypes made, and you have this downtime, and then you can fill your time doing other things. So it's no one week is the same in what we do.
What percentage is the success so far is down to luck, and what's hard work?
Yeah, like it's, isn't it? The harder you work, the luckier you get. I mean, I think it is hard work on a lot of our fronts. I don't put any, like, in terms of timing and luck, we've had bad luck, I guess, if the various crashes and things outside our control, Brexit as well, didn't really affect us at the beginning, but it's certainly affecting us now. We don't do any more business with the UK, which is really unfortunate. Another sort of sad thing, I think, that's happened in the last little while. But yeah, we plough on. Like I said, we're a small company. We pivot to do whatever we feel is best.
As you look back, what mistake have you learned the most from?
I think from my own perspective, and maybe going back to those sort of early surgeons and the tough times that I had there in 2005, and kind of knowing maybe sort of the insecurities of other surgeons, I probably thought they're all very bad people at the time, but now, you know, they're human. They had their own issues and reasons for probably doubting at the time, or kind of me going off on my little tangent. You know, I didn't realize that I probably was that square peg in a round hole back then. Maybe I've sort of matured in that respect, but just the learning the people, more people skills, I think, is better.
And therefore, if you could change one thing, what would it be? Just go back and maybe extend an olive branch back then, or two.
I don't know.
Hit them with an olive branch.
No, I think still doing what I did. You know, it was there was a lot of ballsy stuff I did back then. And I think you need to take that. Back yourself and do things. Mm-hmm. I think leaving medicine in 2005 was probably one of the best things I did. It was a huge decision for me at the time, and it was sort of reverberated a while, but it allowed me the freedom to do other things. Mm-hmm. And I think you get one crack at life. Mm-hmm. And you can't live with regrets, so I had that opportunity and I just took it.
Mm-hmm. I don't know whether your dad was alive at the time, but what did he think about you leaving your medical career, given his long medical career?
Maybe that was he died unfortunately the year before. Maybe I was sort of waiting until I think it was funny. You know, you go back to the family thing, it divided family members at the time. You know, there was and again, it's probably down to people's personalities. You know, some of the family members were conservative and said, "Oh no, you know, we got you into medical school, and why are you throwing this all away for, you know, a life in business or whatever?" But I am truly happy that I made that jump.
But you find that with entrepreneurs, you do need that clarity of purpose. Like, you know, you saw the opportunity there. You believed in the product. You believed in the ability to develop another product. And that clarity of purpose is, you know, some might call it naivety, but I actually think it's much more than that. It's like you've got to believe in your product. Because if you don't, it's very easy to get derailed when the tough times come.
Yeah, I heard one way of thinking it is like if you're in a dilemma and you toss a coin, and if it comes up, like if you're thinking heads and it comes up heads, you know, and you're going with your your initial decision. And if you're not happy with it, you'll, in your mind you'll go, oh, best of three, best of three. And then you know which way you're going to go. So I was happy to have left. And when I actually made the decision, there was no really, no regrets.
You know, outside of the business, in terms of on a personal level, what are you working on?
Well, my other outlets are golf and cricket. I do play social cricket in the summer. It's nice now. We're kind of just got into the season, and it's a good social game.
Do you read much? Do you have to read much?
I don't really. I listen to the odd podcast or the odd audiobook. The last audiobook
I listened to this podcast from now on.
Oh, I have. Yeah, well, I've read it. 100% of my listening. Freakonomics would be one of the earlier books I liked. The Road Less Stupid is probably the latest one, I think, is a very good read too.
Yeah. As you look forward from now, just one thing about, you know, where do you think you're going to need to seek advice going forward?
Yeah, I think as a company, as we grow, my skill set is in the clinical arena and in the R&D space. As we grow, we'll need commercial people. We'll change into a different breed of company that is like, you know, quarterly sales reports and managing the sales teams and expansion into other global markets. That's when we'll hire in people that are in that space, that's their sweet spot. And I'll probably default to the more clinical role, the ambassador role, meeting surgeons. Like, it's great being, I get a great buzz being in surgery, and it's great buzz actually seeing your products being put in surgery. You know, after the birth of my kids, I think when I was putting in the first tightrope and being there when the first X-bolt were putting in, were those moments where you really get a really warm, fuzzy feeling that, you know, now you've made it. You've spent all these years in development and various things, and now you have the final product that's actually being used on someone. I think that gives you a very warm glow.
Are you a bit of a backseat driver, though, when you're seeing them putting the X-bolt in? You go, oh, I wouldn't do it that way.
It's very hard, and I think It's tough for the surgeons sometimes to have me in the operating theatre, I think, because it's like having a backseat driver there, that you just don't want to fail, or you want to show your best and be the best. Whereas when you're a surgeon, you are the captain in your cockpit, and you want to do exactly what you want to do, not be thinking, this is what this guy wants to be looking to do. Yeah. So I'm more conscious of the effect that I would have in the operating theatre.
And just in terms of, you mentioned about, you know, as the business moves on and it moves, becomes more commercial rather than R&D, how will you keep the innovative flame going? If you've been the driver on the clinical side of it, and you're, I wouldn't say distracted, but you're out kind of fulfilling a non-innovation role by being an ambassador to this.
Yeah, I'll say within the product development stream of things. I mean, surgeons do come with ideas to our company, and I mean, one of the collaborative projects we're doing on the humeral nail, we're getting inputs from surgeons in the field. So, I'm not the one brain that's gone in behind everything. It's great to channel it and get things right. I mean, most of the products have gone through probably 10 different iterations of getting better and better. Like, once you think you have that light bulb moment, it's not really it, and it moves on.
Okay. Final tradition we have here is the final question. I'm going to open the book and I'll tell you what your question is. I don't know what it's going to be. All right. It's an interesting one. All right. Your question is, who has been your biggest supporter since you started your career? And is it the same person today?
Oh, gosh. Since I started my career. That's the only one that you can ask me, is it?
That's the only one, I'm afraid.
I'm trying to think of the clinicians. There's been quite a few in Ireland. One or two that spring to mind at the time of 2005, Maurice Nelligan would be one. I think he realised the issues that I've gone through at that time and was very supportive. There's probably heaps of others that I can't sort of name one by one.
And today, who's the biggest support? Besides your wife and family, just I'll give you that one.
Chairman of the board, right. Is very, very supportive of, and he's my number one mentor, I guess, from a business perspective. I think that relationship is probably pivotal, the chairman CEO relationship. Even though I'm a bigger shareholder than him, having half the company, but I need someone who keeps me on the straight and narrow. And my own worst thing is going off in different tangents, and he brings me back and lets me know if take it as the barometer for the company. Is what I'm doing going to advance the company goals? And if it's not doing that, then to not do it.
Very good. Well, that's it for this episode of Everyday Business with Aidan Donnelly. I'd just like to thank my guest, Brian Thorns. Don't forget to like, share and subscribe or comment if you enjoyed what you heard. Many thanks and see you next time.
The participants in this podcast have done so for the purpose of sharing their own individual business experiences. Some are clients of Davy and some are not. They have not received a gratuity or other payment for their time in making the podcast. The views expressed throughout are their own. Warning: the information in this podcast is not a recommendation or investment research. It does not purport to be financial advice. You should speak to your advisor in the context of your own personal circumstances prior to making any financial or investment decision. In the Republic of Ireland, J&E Davy Unlimited Company, trading as Davy and Davy Private Clients, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Davy is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group. In the United Kingdom, Davy Private Clients UK, Davy UK and Davy Capital Markets UK are the trading names of J&E Davy UK Limited. J&E Davy UK Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. J&E Davy UK Limited is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group.